Welcome to Funeral Potatoes for the Singles Ward. Tune in to today's taboo topic with Kaylee and Tracy. Don't feel like we've recorded this early in quite a while.
No, we haven't.
That is okay. I chose this. We will get through this.
This is the result of us procrastinating.
Amen.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah, it happens.
But we're here. We're doing this. And we have got things to say. So, welcome, folks. Let's go ahead and start with our corrections corner right over here. So we both have one thing to share. So, because we talked a lot about, in last week's episode, about some archaeological digs. And so one of the things I referenced was about this guy who, like, funded and did a dig in Mexico or South America who was looking for evidence of the Nephites. So I did find information, and it was actually super easy to find, which I'm really glad about. Yeah, like, I just Googled, like, guy who looks for a Nephite dig and, like, lost his faith. So, it's a 2018 article on science.org titled "How a Mormon Lawyer Transformed Archaeology in Mexico and Ended Up Losing His Faith."
Oh.
There is so much to this, but since it is a corrections corner, I do want to keep this very short. I did just give you guys a title, so if you want to look more into it, please do. He does learn about a lot of interesting stuff during his journeys. I'm just going to go ahead and share some of the very main points. So the article writes that after years of studying maps, Mormon scripture, and Spanish chronicles, Thomas Stewart Ferguson had concluded that the Book of Mormon took place around Mexico. He had come to the jungles of Campeche, northeast of the Isthmus, to find proof. So Ferguson, and then it just goes on to, like, talk about how he had some ideas on, like, where to find some of the temples, how to find this, how to find that. And then it says that Ferguson places faith in the hands of science, not realizing they were the lion's jaws. It's a very amazing line, so I had to, like, throw that in there. But, like, in a perspective, it does share an interesting thought, like, because we are always having to we tend to separate faith and science. And so that's done a lot within religious groups to say, okay, you can only have one or the other. To have faith, you're going to have to let go of all science. You're going to have to, like, take this anti-intellectual stand for everything. Whereas everyone who's a scientist is often, like, immediately considered an atheist. Well, that's not entirely the truth by any means. So anyways, he was able to get funding from, like, the church and from a few other sources. He dug for, like, 10 years, and they found a ton of things, but nothing that had a direct correlation to anything in the Book of Mormon. And actually, big thing that ended up coming out during his dig time came from somewhere else, and that was the Egyptian texts that Joseph Smith had during his days. You know, like, everything we know about, like, with the mummies and everything. And so the church bought all that documentation. Nobody was actually, like, kind of, like, digging into that. Like, the church would, like, collect a lot of things, but they weren't always big on actually doing a lot of history. Like, that kind of started budding up around this time. So he started in, like, the 50s, and then this is in the 60s, okay? And so the text kind of came out, and the more he was reading them, he said the more he realized that Joseph Smith knew nothing about hieroglyphics, and that doubt increased until it broke his faith. And so he ultimately stopped digging. Like, and he'd been working there for years. He was working with some of the top archaeologists in the world and everything. He went back home to Idaho, though, and he would write to others about how he'd lost his faith. But for his family, he didn't really tell them that much. And he'd just go attend church and everything with them. And then, like, through the years, I think he lived for, like, another 10 to 20 years. He would visit the digs that he had, like, really grown to resent and eventually pass.
Oh, that's sad.
It's pretty much a depressing, sad ending for him. He never really found satisfaction in everything. He did find things on his digs. They weren't connected to the LDS church, and that kind of broke him. Yeah. And then, like, just a reminder that our church doesn't take an official position on where the events in the Book of Mormon occurred. There is no official stand. So whether it's in Mexico or Iowa, like, the church doesn't have a stance.
Okay. That is sad. Poor guy.
It is.
All right. Well, in a similar vein, last week while we were talking about the archaeological dig for Zarahemla that was happening in Iowa in November, I mentioned a story that I remembered hearing in Institute many moons ago, where Joseph Smith found a Lamanite or a Nephite skeleton or an altar of some sort in the Midwest. I did some research to make sure that what I said was true, and it is in fact a true story, but I did get some facts wrong previously, so let's fix that. So this all came from the Joseph Smith papers, actually. While Joseph was marching with Zion's camp in 1834, he and the brethren visited, quote, multiple mounds that were created by ancient inhabitants of the country that were believed to be Nephites, Lamanites, and all of those other ites. According to the papers, I'm going to paraphrase the quote because it's a really long section, but it basically says, quote, on top of the mound were stones which presented the appearance of three altars, one above the other, and the remains of bones strewn over the surface of the ground. The brethren procured a shovel and hoe, and removing the earth to the depth of about 1 foot, discovered the skeleton of a man, almost entire, and between his ribs the stone point of a Lamanitish arrow, which evidently produced his death. The contemplation of the scenery produced peculiar sensations in our bosoms, and subsequently visions of the past being opened to my understanding. The person whose skeleton was before us was a white Lamanite, a large, thick-set man, and a man of God. His name was Zelph. He was killed in battle by the arrow found among his ribs during the last great struggle with the Lamanites and the Nephites, end quote. Additionally, I found an article from LDS Living by Book of Mormon Central, which is a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to making the Book of Mormon accessible and comprehensible everywhere. They quoted church historian Donald Q. Cannon, who said, quote, these accounts indicate that Joseph Smith believed that the Book of Mormon history, or at least part of it, transpired in North America, end quote. The article continues and then says, quote, while this may be true, we cannot be certain how Zelph relates to any specific Book of Mormon places or events, and therefore his story cannot be used as proof in support of any particular geography. Cannon himself did not feel that Joseph Smith's statement pinned Book of Mormon geography down to North America, but rather raises the feasibility of a connection between Central America and North America, end quote. So he did find a skeleton. He had a vision, too, about who this person was, and that's what we know. But again, like you just said, like, there's no concrete statement from the church that says, like, it happened in this place. So it's still up for interpretation and question.
Honestly, yeah. Like, I don't really think the church will, like, ever take a stance on this, because then it sets up a lot of expectations and assumptions that I don't think the church would want to, like, keep adding to and explaining and everything. So
I still like my thought from last week when I said that we're going to get to the other side and be like, so where did Lehi and Nephi and the whole family land? And Jesus will be like, Nephi who? So
yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, we'll see.
Nobody knows for sure, but it'll be entertaining to me nonetheless. Yeah. If he does in fact end up being a not real person, I would laugh for days in the spirit world. You would hear me laughing in the real mortal world. You would hear that ghost laugh.
That will be our sign to know. No, the truth.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
Mark my words. That's, you will hear funny. My phantom laughter from the beyond. Before we get started, we wanted to remind you all that our podcast is now a member of the Dialogue Podcast Network. Dialogue is a collective of independent and interesting podcasts who promote thoughtful, respectful, and engaging inquiry and discussion into all aspects of the LDS tradition, thought, arts, and culture. You can support our podcast and others in the network by subscribing at dialoguejournal.com. Subscribers receive special benefits like ad-free episodes and bonus content. You can learn more at dialoguejournal.com. Okay, so let's get into today.
Today's topic, religious violence.
we have a fairly heavy topic today, but it does not include any trigger warnings because we don't really get into like nitty-gritty stuff. We're keeping it as light as possible. We're just keeping it historical, I guess. It is fascinating too. Like from what we researched, it's, how do I want to phrase this? The way that like we have been seeing people interpreting religious freedom over the last few years in America specifically, that's not at all the same level of religious oppression, violence, or anything that has happened historically in the world. And like Americans need to calm down about this I'm being oppressed nonsense, because you're really not.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, and I mean, you can point to any, just about any religious group, and everyone has been oppressed and persecuted at one point. That's not to negate anything, but it is to highlight, like, you do need to be absolutely aware of what's going on and to understand what oppression really is, to understand like what your rights and what the law is, and to come with that understanding before you're making assumptions about what is really going on for you. But then you also need to take more seriously what other people say as well.
Exactly. So while people tend to talk big about civilization in like first and third world countries, it's really important that we acknowledge that there is a lot of effort, loss, pain, and rebuilding that all of these civilizations require. Today, since we already said we're going to be talking about religious violence, we wanted to talk about what it is, how it's played a part in world history and in church history, and then what we can do about it today to prevent it happening around us, to communities that we're connected to, and just do what we can to make sure that this isn't happening to other religions. So remember, again, we are not experts. We are amateurs and amateur researchers as well. But we're going to be sharing some history, some of our perspectives, and what we think could and should happen going forward.
And then like one thing also just to note is like, as we get into religious violence, it's really easy to like put labels on things and be like, okay, yeah, this stuff is definitely over. And we like to think that we're not fighting church to church today. It's not the whole drama with like burnings and hangings and everything anymore. But really, that's just because the battleground has effectively changed. Our religions reinforce our personal beliefs, and those beliefs are how we view the world and what we do on a daily basis. Thus, our religion, organized or not, our beliefs impact our actions. It impacts how we see things, how we judge things, and we can see how that essentially affects how everything is viewed today in this world. So whether or not it's an organized religion fighting, there is a lot of belief behind any violence that is happening today that we need to take into consideration.
Exactly. So let's get into it.
Yes. All right. So let's get precise about what gets termed as religious violence. So while we know we can't always rely on Wikipedia, we do feel that the definition here does encapsulate the basics. So on there, it says that religious violence covers phenomena where religion is either the subject or the object of violent behavior. All the religions of the world contain narratives, symbols, and metaphors of violence and war. Religious violence is violence that is motivated by or in reaction to religious precepts, texts, or the doctrines of a target or an attacker. It includes violence against religious institutions, people, objects, or events. Religious violence does not exclusively include acts which are committed by religious groups. Instead, it includes acts which are committed against religious groups. So we do want to include religious oppression and religious conflict under the umbrella term of religious violence. So basically, punishment and trouble that gets pointed at a group of people because of their beliefs or their lack of. And so while we do discuss this topic, we do want to put in another reminder. A few reminders. First, history is typically written by one party, which often makes it hard to understand certain situations. If only the conquerors are writing, we only get their perspective on what things happened and what beliefs were and so on. So without hearing both sides' interpretations of what happened, we can only get part of the truth. So while we discuss this information today, we do invite you to keep an open mind and try to consider how each side was affected by what is being shared. We just need to be able to keep in mind what happens to the people of the religion or the victims, and we need to keep in mind what happens because of the people of a certain religion, the perpetrators.
So the second thing we want to remind you all is that we cannot talk about religious violence and oppression without talking about colonization and imperialism. Both were once considered honorable and the best way for empires to expand and for cultures to broaden. But society is learning, or rather finally listening to, what marginalized communities have been saying all along. Colonization and imperialism are very problematic. To define them, according to dictionary.com, colonization is, quote, the act or process of settling among and establishing control over the indigenous people of an area, end quote. Similarly, according to dictionary.com again, imperialism is, quote, a policy of extending a country's political power, economic access, and influence through diplomacy or military force, end quote. The most famous examples of this include the UK's control of almost the entire world for many, many years. But if we wanted to get like specific, like their control of India and basically South Asia, and then the pilgrims coming from the UK to the US and continually pushing Native Americans further and further west and displacing them, and then many, many more examples. You guys can take your own time away from this and research that. But however you want to label it, they're both bad. It is a form of violence, even when it looks peaceful on the surface. But we'll get into this a little bit more in a minute.
All right, so now we're going to start diving into some basic world history. Now, please note, we will be glossing over this section because, firstly, we are not historians and thus not experts. And secondly, this material has consumed articles and books and documentaries and so much more. We literally cannot fit every religious conflict into this chapter, into this episode. We can't include all of them, and you're going to be asked thinking, okay, of course we're going to talk about this, and if we don't, I'm sorry, we can't fit in every religious conflict in here. So we're just highlighting a few that people may or may not know about and providing a little bit of context from our perspectives.
So the first one we're going to talk about is the Spanish Inquisition. All of this information in this section we compiled from the Encyclopedia Britannica website. So for those of you that aren't familiar with it, the Spanish Inquisition was established by King Ferdinand II and Queen Isabella I to maintain Catholic orthodoxy in their kingdoms in Spain and in each Spanish colony, which included Central and South America, the Philippines at this point in time, and other locations. It was originally intended to identify heretics among those who converted from Judaism and Islam to Catholicism. But this ended up getting very twisted into persecution, legal prosecution of those who refused to convert to Catholicism in those colonies, and then the mass expulsion of Jews and Muslims from Spain, as well as multiple executions. Estimates say that over 160,000 people were persecuted or tortured and then prosecuted, which were tortured again and had their civil rights removed in court cases and legal proceedings. Between 3,000 to 5,000 people were executed during this time. This technically went on from 1478 to 1834. So almost 400 years, when it was officially disbanded by Queen Maria Cristina de Borbon in 1834, but most heavily happened during the 15 and 1600s.
I did not know that went on that long. Oh my gosh, that's insane. It's so easy to forget some of the things in history were really started by religious violence. That's insane, though. And then, of course, like we do kind of consider like the first Christians and everything. So we don't really consider people as Christians until like after Christ was born. But like there were believers waiting for him, ready for him. A lot of them were persecuted and lost their lives. I mean, John the Baptist, he was born right when Jesus was born as well. He was Jesus's own cousin and he was beheaded. And Jesus was crucified. Like he is Christ, but he kind of counts as a Christian. I don't know how you want to put that. But he definitely died because of religious violence. And most of his disciples were killed for their beliefs as well. We never really talk about how all of them died. So I just pulled this information from Christianity.com because I knew like Peter was crucified upside down and that was kind of it.
Yeah, it's bad.
It is bad. Gosh. So they don't really say when all of this happened, but there's like a lot of various reports. Some are like super sure and others are not as certain. And a lot of this happened like when they were traveling and preaching. So Peter was crucified upside down. Paul was beheaded. Andrew was also said to be crucified. Thomas was said to be killed by four spears. Some say that Matthew was stabbed to death. Bartholomew, he was said to be martyred for the gospel. James, the son of Alphaeus, was stoned and then clubbed to death.
Ooh.
Simon was killed for not sacrificing to other gods. And Matthias, who had replaced Judas, was burned to death.
Gosh.
It's insane. And then also, like, during that early time of when they were preaching the gospel and everything, those early Christians were also seriously attacked and killed within religious violence. So the University of Queensland has gathered a lot of data and information on early Christians. So I pulled information from their site. So they noted how, like, some things have been noted incorrectly in history and some others did have basis. They said that the Emperor Nero is referred to as the first persecutor of the Christians by Lactantius. After the Great Fire of Rome in AD 64, when rumors swirled that the emperor himself was responsible, because he was crazy, Nero blamed the Christians for that instead. According to the Roman historian Tacitus, Nero had the Christians covered in wild beast skins and torn to death by dogs.
Ugh.
So, however, the initiative to punish Christians did not just come from the emperors at all, but really from below. In the case of Polycarp, who was burned alive, the people of Smyrna were even said to have, like, joined in enthusiastically to find wood for the fire. So there was a ton of information, but in the early 80 years, Christians were attacked and killed for their faith, mostly for the refusal to, like, sacrifice to other gods. A lot of that's where it was coming from. Not just because of what they believed in, but because they wouldn't do other things. Not that there's much of a difference, but it is an excuse that got used that I found interesting. So anyways, in some places, the murder or attempted genocide of Christians was a day of festivities for everyone else. Some leaders totally wanted to be rid of them, and others said people could believe as they chose. A lot of the emperors and other ruling leaders said different things. But mobs were bloodthirsty and eager for fun, so a lot of the time, the trouble actually came from just the people at, you know, ground level with them, which I thought was interesting because we do tend to blame a lot of the leaders.
All right. So this next one, I just called it, there were too many to count in Southeast Asia because there were so many problems. All of this information that I got here was compiled from AsianStudies.org. It explained that pre-European colonization, there were frequent wars and conflicts between religious groups, sometimes between the same religious group, like it could be like Catholics versus Catholics, but they just wanted more space. Like it could have just been territory wars, really. An example that they shared was negotiating border regions between Burmese states and the Malay Peninsula. After European colonization came to town, there were frequent political and territorial wars, but religion rarely played a part in these conflicts. It wasn't really until post-World War II when ethnic religious minorities tried to escape from or separate from majority nations. For example, in the Philippines specifically, from the early 1900s to the 1970s, the minority Muslim community wanted to separate from the largely Catholic majority in the southernmost island of Mindanao. The Muslim people in Mindanao had their own ruler, they had their own way of life, and they were just living, basically. Doing things, living their best life. And then at the turn of the 20th century, they were basically forced to live the way that the Americans and the Spaniards believed was the best way, meaning their way. So the Moro Sulu Sultan refused a treaty from the US that sided with Spain, and he basically demanded a renegotiation on their whole way of life down there, which basically the US did not like. They didn't handle it well. And then the Philippine-American War broke out shortly thereafter. Later, in the 1930s, the U.S. pushed Filipinos, like native Filipinos, to Mindanao in a way to maintain an alliance with Spain, but it led to continued Catholic-Muslim conflict and then a full-out revolt by Muslims in the 1950s and then again in the 1970s. And then even today, there are still many, many conflicts between Catholics and Muslims in Mindanao. And a lot of it stems from each group being displaced throughout the last few centuries in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Okay, so then another one is Muslims versus Hindus in India. So there's actually a long, long history of conflict between Hindus and Muslims in India. There is no real inciting incident, but there's just constant friction between the two groups. In the 16th century, the Mughal Emperor Akbar, who was Muslim, married Mariam-uz-Zamani, who was Hindu, and she was the principal wife slash queen consort. He didn't force her to convert to Islam, which was like super radical for that time too. Like he allowed her to continue worshiping her Hindu faith and doing it in the palace as well, like doing her religious rituals in the palace. Not only was this radical for the time, because, you know, like the emperor usually makes people do whatever they want, but there were also so many political problems between Hindus and Muslims at that time in India. Before his reign as emperor, Hindus were forced to convert to Islam, and those who remained Hindu had to pay insane taxes to do their religious pilgrimages, and they were constantly persecuted by Muslims. While he was the emperor, he allowed Hindus to convert back to Hinduism without facing any kind of penalty, and he removed the tax on Hindu pilgrimages like they had in place for Muslim pilgrimages. If you want to see like a fun dramatization of it, you should watch the 2008 Bollywood film Jodha Akbar.
Ooh.
It's starring Hrithik Roshan and Aishwarya Rai. It's so good. It's available on Netflix. Oh my gosh. It's yeah? a beautiful movie.
I love a good Bollywood film, and they're all good.
Okay. It's really, really good.
That's what I'm doing this weekend.
Okay, fast forward to 2014 now, and the Prime Minister's Hindu Nationalist Party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, came to power. Hate crimes and lynching towards Muslims were severely on the rise. The BJP denies any connection to these hate crimes, but rarely condemn the actions when they occur. You've probably seen this more recently in like Twitter and online, but December 2021 to March 7th of this year, 2022, an election cycle was occurring in 5 states in India, including the most populated Uttar Pradesh. On justsecurity.org, it said, quote, "Amid the balloting, Hindu nationalist leaders are energizing their constituents with calls for mass violence. Militant campaigns based on conspiracy theories that Muslim men are marrying Hindu women to imperil and overpower Hindu culture, and a new law premised on that belief, stand to override the rights of Muslims and other minority communities. The elected head of state, Chief Minister Yogi Adityanath, is a Hindu nationalist demagogue from the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, and he is seeking a new term with a divisive electioneering strategy that pits minority groups against the majority," end quote. I'm trying not to relate it to American culture and politics, but like what we've been experiencing in America has not just been happening here. Like all of these political battles between minority groups and marginalized people are happening everywhere in the world, and it's most explosive in India right now. This type of conflict continues to bubble up every year or so, with mosques, temples, and other religious sites being vandalized and sometimes destroyed. And then most recently, it's exploded as that political leader is making divisive election statements and inciting violent acts among his constituents. He'll claim to the end of the world that he's not inciting these incidents, but he won't condemn them when they happen.
Unbelievable.
The fact that he is stirring up his constituents to go and like attack Muslims and other marginalized groups in the sake of defending what he believes is ideal India. Like it's getting so much worse. And so
that's terrible.
It's still happening today.
Yeah. Jeez. I mean, yeah, you'll find that all over. Like, I used to try to think of this all in, like, older, like, contexts and everything. Like, yeah, none of this happens anymore. Like, indigenous communities are still allowed to practice their own beliefs, which is technically the truth, but, like...
But not really.
There's a lot of problems with that all over. Yeah. I traveled to Belfast a few years ago and realized that there is still very serious contention between the Catholics and Protestants. And then there's been all the problems going on within China with camps growing and everything. Like, there is so many problems all over the world still. It's not something of the past.
And it's sad, not only because it's like still happening, but because there are so many people like us around the world that don't hear about these things because it's not getting reported as much as it should
right. be. Right. That is absolutely correct. And it's so easy to be like, okay, yeah, whatever. Like, I don't press a source. I'm not going to believe that this is happening to hundreds and thousands and millions of people right now. It's insane. There are people around the world right now being persecuted who are suffering religious violence, who are committing religious violence, and so many more people just, yeah, don't really know about it and thus aren't doing anything to help each other out, which is a huge problem. Okay, we're going to get back to our list. This is one of the few that I actually, like, do know something about because as a redhead, I am bound to enjoy a redheaded ruler, especially when it's a woman. So we've got Bloody Mary and Queen Elizabeth I. So we've got some information pulled from Britannica here. So we already know King Henry VIII was a douche who did a lot of dumb things.
So many. There's a whole musical about it now.
Everything he did was wrong. Anyway, so we've got Mary I of England, a.k.a. Mary Tudor, a.k.a. Bloody Mary, who is the daughter of King Henry VIII and his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. So Mary was set to become crown princess and one day queen. But then Henry separated from the Catholic Church so he could divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. Elizabeth I was daughter of Anne Boleyn and King Henry VIII. And as soon as she was born, she became next in line to become Queen of England. So with the divorce, Mary was stripped of her title and forced to become a lady-in-waiting to her half-sister, who was an infant. So, like, she was seriously demoted. I think she was, like, 8 years old or something at the time. Like, so she had an idea of, like, what was going on. And so, anyways, like, years later, though, like, Henry does restore Mary's title after he marries his fifth wife, Catherine Howard. So then Mary then became second in line for the throne when Henry would die. It would be her brother Edward, then it was supposed to be Mary, and then Elizabeth if the situation came. And kind of the situation started to rise. So King Henry died. Mary essentially became Queen of England. So she's an adult. She's desperate to bring England back to the Catholic Church, which she kept her mother's faith, which totally makes sense. So she marries Prince Philip II of Spain. And unfortunately, all hell breaks loose. Parliament loses their minds because they're all Protestant. They're Church of England, like King Henry VIII had, like, kind of enforced. And so, like, they considered it a slap in the face that she would disregard that they were doing all their wishes and so on. So after the wedding, a Protestant riot breaks out because she is reviving the laws of against heresy. So if you guys know anything about the Spanish Inquisition, you can start getting an idea here. So for the next 3 years, she had people relentlessly beat, tortured, and burned at the stake for heresy against the Catholic Church. I mean, she was getting so many people killed. That is how she got the name of Bloody Mary. And so during that time, she did keep her sister, Elizabeth, in prison.
Yeah. Didn't she lock her in the Tower of London? And that's where Anne Boleyn, like Elizabeth's mom, spent the last of her days too.
Yeah.
So shady.
It sure is. So, yeah. And then, like, Elizabeth was never Catholic. She was
Church of England.
Yeah. Because that's what her mother and father kind of were at the time. So anyways, 1559, Mary dies. Elizabeth, the only surviving child of King Henry VIII, becomes queen. And she inherits a country in religious shambles and turmoil. I mean, especially like when you think about this point in time, religion was very much dominant within the government and everything. That was how people always ruled. Like, the fact that we separated church and state later on is like was a huge kind of situation. But, like, I mean, there have been people who tried. Like, Elizabeth did want a religiously neutral country, and so she did work to abolish some extremism, theological debate, and, like, people calling each other heretics. She did revise acts of supremacy to avoid papal rule, which basically means to avoid the head of any church being so high in power as to control the country. So they were trying to do something like the division of church and state. And she did work on including Catholics and Protestants in Parliament and in the House of Lords. Anyone who fell into debate or argument of her position as the Supreme Governor of the Church of England, was sent to the Tower of London, though. She wasn't as bloody as Mary, but she did do some very bloody things. Then she started forbidding Catholic priests from holding Mass and keeping them from worship. They would basically have to pay a fine if they did. So she tried for a little bit, it seems, and then she kind of just cut off the Catholics. She only allowed Protestant worship, she forbade religious pilgrimages, and everything she did was extreme and basically forced the entire country into worshiping the same way she believed Protestants should. She started off kind of cool, but she definitely did a lot of very violent things. Not as violent as her predecessor, but still not that cool.
Yeah. All right, so the last one we wanted to bring up is very American and very modern. It is the Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh.
Yep. And this information comes from Britannica again. So the Westboro Baptist Church, for those of you that don't know it, is a church from Topeka, Kansas, known for vehemently opposing pretty much everything. And they are often seen protesting any and everything from gay rights to gun control. The church describes itself as an old-school Baptist church based on a strict interpretation of Calvinist principles. This church has chosen to be really on the bad side of every argument. For example, they famously condoned 9/11, saying that it was God's retribution for sin, as well as standing outside of funerals of veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan in the early 2000s, and they would protest and say things like, thank God for dead soldiers and God hates the U.S. and awful things like that.
Oh my gosh.
They frequently persecute other religions too, most notably Judaism, because they firmly believe that Jews killed Jesus, therefore they hate all Jews. Even though the church won a freedom of speech case in the U.S. Supreme Court in 2011, a number of states and international legislatures actually have responded to their picketing by establishing buffer zones specifically for funerals in which protest activity is prohibited. The United Kingdom and Canada have barred members of the church from entering their countries as well because of how intense their protesting and persecution are.
Oh my gosh, I did not know that.
That blew my mind. But yeah, that's just the quick breakdown of the Westboro Baptist Church.
That's amazing. Good.
I just feel like if you're going to protest anything, why are you going to a funeral? Like, a funeral should be like the most off-limit thing to go to protest. Like, that's just so disrespectful and rude. It's so bad.
That's like stabbing someone in the back and just doing it repeatedly. Like, that's cruel. Yeah. So these are... How many examples did we have? We only noted 6 points in history. These religions and wars, these are just a few noteworthy examples that we wanted to bring up today. And like we said, we know we left out a lot because we have different organized religions and there are other beliefs that encourage us to entertain certain behavior. And there are a lot of belief systems that are actually like could be qualified as a religion. I was reading this very interesting book called Sapiens, and this is written by Yuval Noah Harari, and it is a very insightful book, just kind of about like humanity like throughout the ages and everything. And they were pointing out that capitalism would qualify as a religion because of all the tenets that it subscribes to. So there are things like that that like we support, that we believe in to a certain extent, that while it's not considered like an organized religion, it is still a religious type of belief.
Yep.
And like there's rounds with guilt, religious organized religion, like, because in capitalism we've had terrible practices and ideas like the slave trade and the colonialism and the imperialism that we were talking about, like everything, like all that like builds up together, and those are like very strongly held beliefs that create systems that can necessarily be counted mm-hmm. as religious groups, which I thought was insane, but it makes sense.
I know.
I hate it. It's I hate
true,
everything.
Though, and how swept up in capitalism people get and like hyper-focused on it. So yeah, it totally makes sense.
Right. But yeah, so that is a very, very, very brief note or two of history about religious violence. And so what we all now want to do, our next step, is to look into Mormon and LDS related violence, kind of what's been done to us and what we've done to others. I mean, some of you may be thinking, okay, like, you know, what about us? You've talked about the Catholics, you've talked about the Muslims, what about us? We've been persecuted, we've been tortured and driven out of our homes and tarred and feathered and murdered for being Mormon. Where's our recognition and awareness? That's true. That's fair. That's valid, because that has happened. There is no religious group that has had a very peaceful transition into growing and cultivating followers and everything. Our early church history is rife with examples of us being persecuted. From the time Joseph received the gold plates, he had a target on his back and was attacked for not denying the faith and saying he created the entire story himself. Not only was he attacked, but anyone who joined the fledgling church was also attacked. We have records in church history archives of stories about the saints fleeing from place to place to find safety and refuge. We've got Palmyra, Kirtland, multiple places in Missouri, Iowa, Nauvoo, and crossing the plains to make it to the Salt Lake Valley to settle. Even in Utah, the saints were periodically checked on by the government and persecuted. Like, we know it was legal to kill Mormons in Missouri until, like, what, the 70s?
Basically, yeah, in Missouri specifically.
Yeah.
So we don't really need to go through the multiple stories of early church members being persecuted because we know them. It's our history. And frankly, I will say it, I don't want to go over the details of the many persecutions suffered in church history because we spent all of 2021 discussing it during Come Follow Me. The narrative makes us look like complete victims when that hasn't always been the case. Sometimes, and more often than not, we have been just as guilty of persecuting other religions, minorities, and groups as we have been on the receiving end of this persecution.
We're not justifying why any Mormons were killed in the early days. We're just saying that some people actually did have reasons and concerns. Polygamy was a concern for a lot of people who thought they were losing their children, for example. When Joseph Smith was running for president, he was raising some concerns. They were doing some sketchy things at various points that the church won't talk about, but some people had very serious concerns.
Yeah. And I mean, granted, sometimes it was just really terrible. People were like afraid of the unknown, so they would persecute the church. And like, I understand that. Sometimes it's unprovoked and we can't handle that. But we need to acknowledge the fact that we have been persecutors ourselves, and that is something that does not get discussed enough in church history whatsoever. In an incredible article by The Advocate, which is the world's leading source of LGBTQ+ news and politics, this article in October 2016 says, quote, "If Mormons truly see themselves as an oppressed minority group, why do they continue to oppress other minority groups? Granted, most LDS members are kind, generous, sturdy people who mean no harm. But as an institution, the church continues to harm minorities. Yes, the church has taken progressive stances on immigration and the refugee situation, but its recent history of oppression of LGBT people can overshadow those few commendable places where they've broken away from the Republican Party line. In fact, Mormons' history of oppressing others extends back further than their time oppressing LGBT people. Even when Mormons' wounds were fresh, they were inflicting wounds on others," end quote. So now, some of you may be like, you're lying to me, I don't believe you, this article is very biased, blah, blah, blah. That's fine, you're allowed to feel that way. If you don't believe us or this article, here are some additional facts for you. In a Salt Lake Tribune article from February 2008, it details an account of a pioneer who was at the 1863 Bear River Massacre, where over 400 Shoshone natives were murdered by local volunteers. Local volunteers from Cache Valley. We're omitting a lot of information because of time, but essentially, the Shoshone tribe had been forced off of their land yet again, and were getting reasonably annoyed, and they were pushing back. The U.S. government got involved and asked for volunteers nearby to take care of it. In this account, it details how many people from the area volunteered, and they were more than happy to leave their newly settled Salt Lake Valley to quote-unquote handle the native problem. And it's disgusting how quickly we forget what it's like to be oppressed and refugees when literally 20 years prior, we were fleeing west. It's just appalling.
Seriously, that's so disgusting. And yeah, we often just talk about how great the pioneers were, how hard everything was for them, without considering what else was going on. Like, if you dig into the early records,
it's bad.
Which the church does try to hide. Yeah, it's so bad. It's terrible. It is beyond terrible.
Well, it's gonna get worse. So another example is the Mountain Meadows Massacre, which I did not know about. I've heard like the name, but I didn't know what it actually was until I did this research. It's an absolute nightmare of a tragedy that is very often ignored or swept under the rug. So again, for time's sake, we're going to give a very brief rundown of what happened, but it's horrible and you should look into it. September 7th through 11th in 1857, literally 10 years after settling in the Salt Lake Valley, Mormon settlers attacked and murdered a wagon team that was crossing from Arkansas to California through southwest Utah, slaughtering nearly 120 people. As if that wasn't bad enough, those same people spared 17 children who were under the age of 8, believing they were too young to be able to retell what happened to anyone, specifically authorities, and they tried adopting them into nearby Mormon families. The children were not taken care of whatsoever. Some were treated like prisoners, most were starved, and often neglected. It took 2 years for the U.S. military to be able to intervene and get those kids out and back to Arkansas to live with relatives.
Holy crap.
To make matters worse, because it has to get worse,
of course,
these people that committed this atrocity were not prosecuted until 1874.
Oh, geez.
And this is because the onset of the Civil War happened in 1861, so a few years after that, which made it impossible to have any kind of court proceedings that were planned for these men. They basically roamed free for 10 years until they were finally able to have, like, some sort of prosecution. Ridiculous.
I mean, I'd heard a little bit about the massacre, but I didn't have the numbers. I didn't have the information about the kids. Did they not kill all the kids that were underage? Did they kill some of the 9-year-olds? Like, what sane person is okay doing something like that?
In one of the things I read about this, there was a 12-year-old girl who was spared at first. I said between September 7th and 11th because it literally happened over multiple days, like these concentrated attacks on this wagon team. There was a 12-year-old girl who was spared for most of those days until the very last day of the massacre. And then they were like, no, she's too old. She'll spill. And they killed her.
Oh my gosh.
In front of all of those other little kids too. Like, the kids saw everything.
Yeah.
But most of them were under the age of 8 that were spared.
That's absolutely insane. I don't have words for anything more.
And it's 10 years after we settled in Utah. Like, 10 years. How can you forget that quickly what it's like to leave your home, cross the plains, do the hardest trek possible, and then turn to this wagon team that is doing the exact same thing? They're looking for freedom. They're looking for a new life out west, and you just completely destroy them.
There's no good reason. There's no way to justify that behavior, whether you have your religious excuses or not. Like, in no situation. Ew.
Okay. So the last one, I'm sorry, it's just terrible.
No, it's fine. We're not outright murdering people now, which is good, but we do have to consider how we do look at minorities and the LGBTQ plus community in the church. So in 2016, the church, along with multiple other religious leaders, sent a letter to President Obama calling for a renunciation of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights report, peaceful coexistence, reconciling non-discrimination principles with civil liberties. So the report stated, the phrases religious liberty and religious freedom will stand for nothing except hypocrisy so long as they remain code words for discrimination, intolerance, racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, Christian supremacy, or any form of intolerance. So the article from Advocate explained that the church and other religious institutions said, slandering ideas and arguments with which one disagrees as racism or phobia not only cheapens the meaning of those words, but can have a chilling effect on healthy debate over or dissent from the prevailing orthodoxy. We are one in demanding that no American citizen or institution be labeled by their government as bigoted because of their religious views and dismissed from the political life of our nation for holding those views. And yet that is precisely what the Civil Rights Commission report does. So basically, the church just doesn't want to be called a bigot for homophobia and so on.
Yeah, they don't want to be called out for being bigoted.
Yeah, they want to hold on to, I mean, really, those are some violent beliefs, and they want to make sure that they can't be attacked for them, which I do get from one perspective, like, and that is like the way I grew up. Like, you do need to make sure that you can have your religious beliefs and not have them infringed upon. But when your religious beliefs are infringing on others, then you're crossing a line. So we've already talked a lot about what the church has done to members of the LGBTQ plus community in our last season, like during our Pride series. But if we want to look more closely at what's happening today, we can see that BYU and the church is very threatened by the LGBTQ plus community. And I mean, making demonstrations like Rainbow Day and the lighting of the Y is seen as an act of violence against the school. Like, they're getting very defensive.
Yeah, there are a lot of problems and we are not going to pretend that this is not the case. While we don't expect everyone to be happy with church leaders, it is allowed to have high standards and expect leaders to try their best and to make up for their mistakes, which is what we're ultimately hoping for. Just like you said, Kaylee, like, we understand the importance of having religious freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of believing, whatever you want to believe. But when you are actively campaigning against marginalized groups, that's when it becomes a problem. And it's not about your religious beliefs anymore. It wholly becomes you being a bigot. That's really all it is. It's you being a bigoted person.
Yeah, simple as that. And I mean, we do know that it often feels like an either or situation when you are in a organized faith and religion. It, like, you have to accept all the teachings or you can't accept none of them. You're either a member or you're not. But life is more nuanced than that. Like, we've talked countless, especially in season two, about the gray areas within our faith. Many things that seem opposing can all be true at once. We can't believe in the doctrine, for example, without supporting the policy and culture that is hurting so many people. It's something that we are personally responsible for figuring out for ourselves. We choose what we believe and do, whether we are in an organized religion or not. Like, we have our own beliefs, our own morals, and we use them to live our lives. What many people have done in the past is kind of like leave behind their religions and their churches and find others that they find more ideal. Sometimes they turn to other versions of their God, to their deity, and some give up on everything. They find what works best for them. Just like some join the Church of Satan, which honestly is kind of cool. I just want to bring this up because they are a very interesting organization because
they don't worship Satan.
No, they don't. They are not focused on worshiping. They're focused on being good people, essentially. That's like their whole thing. So pulled from Britannica, which is apparently our main resource for
it's
this.
A good encyclopedia, man.
It is good. It is good. So they say that the Church of Satan, a counterculture group founded in the 1960s by Anton Sander LaVey, who was born Howard Stanton Levy. Contrary to its name, the church does not promote evil, but rather focuses on humanistic values. So, like, you can be a card-carrying member, essentially, and be protected in a lot of ways for certain things, like abortion. If you're a card-carrying member, like, they consider it a ritual abortion, and that becomes a religiously protected right for them. I find them very interesting through the last couple of years because they're not focused on worship. They're just focused on being good people, not infringing on other people's rights, and just trying to take care of themselves and each other, which every religion preaches, but doesn't always do, as we can see from history.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I remember, like, the satanic panic from when we were young and, like, from before that even, too.
Basically based on nothing as it was.
Yeah, it's nothing.
I mean, some people do some Satanist stuff. Like, we're not going to, like, totally write that out. There are some. But, like, the Church of Satan is not focused on worshiping Satan. That's not a thing.
Like you said, like, they try their hardest to just be good people, promote taking care of one another, loving your fellow man, doing what's best for others, nature, like, everything around you, and, like, just trying to be good humans, which is what we're all trying to do here in religions. But we are seriously failing at because we get so caught up in the nitty-gritty details of, like, oh, well, my religion says that we can do this. That means that you can't do that because my religion says that you can't do that. When in reality, it shouldn't be pushing your beliefs on someone else. It should just be try to be the best person that you can be. That's what my religion teaches. And that's what I hope that yours is teaching you also.
Yeah. Yeah. We just tend to get focused on, like,
stupid crap.
Yeah, it's like we were so determined to make sure that no one can tell us, like, what to do, that we'll become the oppressor to avoid oppression. And then they'll still pretend to be the oppressed. So for the next main section that we're discussing in our episode is about facing religious violence today. So the World Economic Forum has an article titled "Religious Violence is on the Rise. What can faith-based communities do about it?" It was written, I think, in 2019 by Robert Muga and Ali Velshi. And so they just brought up a few really interesting points. So they wrote that religious violence is undergoing a revival. The past decade has witnessed a sharp increase in violent sectarian or religious tensions. These range from Islamic extremists waging global jihad and power struggles between Sunni and Shia Muslims in the Middle East, to the persecution of Rohingya in Myanmar, and outbreaks of violence between Christians and Muslims across Africa. According to Pew, in 2018, more than a quarter of the world's countries experienced a high incidence of hostilities motivated by religious hatred, mob violence related to religion, terrorism, and harassment of women for violating religious codes. The spike in religious violence is global and affects virtually every religious group. They also note that in an era of turbulence and uncertainty, interfaith action may offer an important antidote to religious violence. Religious communities can and do offer a reminder of the core principles of our common humanity. While not the exclusive preserve of faith-based groups, the conscious spread of values of empathy, compassion, forgiveness, and altruism are needed today more than ever. The persistent calls for patience, tolerance, understanding, face-to-face dialogue, and reconciliation are more important than ever, given today's spiraling polarization and the dangerous anonymity provided by social media. So they just really go on and they talk about a lot of things that have been going on and things that really do need to be happening. And I really liked a lot of what they were saying. They were talking about how, you know, like, we need to be stepping up to play a part in mediations, to be there and supporting agreements and providing insights and awareness of religious concerns. So, I mean, ultimately, we can't stop everything, but we can be doing what we can to take action, to create communication and understanding before these things happen.
Yeah. When you posed the question, like, how do we protect ourselves from religious violence? All I could think was, like, I don't think we can truly protect ourselves from this, because hate crimes are going to happen whether we're ready for them or not. The world is really full of hate right now, and we know that hate crimes have been steadily on the rise over the last 5 years, more than 5 years, honestly. And the only thing that we can do is really prepare ourselves to respond when those events happen. Will we boldly testify in the face of an adversary? Will we try to de-escalate the situation so it ends peacefully? Will we match the violence with violence and fight to the death if someone comes for you violently because of your religious beliefs? What are you going to do? How we choose to respond to these events will define how we protect ourselves and others going forward, which leads us into the next section, which is how to protect others. So we need to remember that religious liberty allows us to hold our own beliefs. There's a line that should not be crossed where we would infringe upon another person's rights. This is something that we need to consider wherever we are, no matter who we are, and no matter who we're with. There's a lot at play when religious violence takes place, and we can't always stop it, but we can do our best to be prepared. We need to do things like understand our state and federal discrimination laws, ensure related policies at our workplace are enforced, and that we're supporting team members if and when things happen. We need to stand up for those of other faiths when they're attacked. We need to acknowledge our own religious differences and have open communication with those people, especially about privilege and oppression. We need to consider the separation of science and religion in laws, which we have seen come up a lot recently with, like, abortion laws and trans laws. And we need to... Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, it just drives me nuts because there are a lot of laws that are getting made based off of religious beliefs versus science, which is kind of what we should be doing things based on if we're going to keep religion out of the state. So, like, my example for this was just that, like, there is the idea that there are two genders, and so that gets applied into some laws. This is scientifically incorrect. That belief only exists because of religious beliefs, and religious beliefs can often be contrary to reality at times. So when you support certain leaders and when you support a law, you need to be considering data on how this will impact people, who this will impact, and science on how honest and truthful this is, instead of just basing every decision of yours off of your faith.
I firmly believe that if my freedom of choice, religion, and speech has been fought tirelessly for, that it's my responsibility to do the exact same thing to protect the freedom of choice, religion, and speech of other people, even if their choices, beliefs, and speech differ from mine. It doesn't matter. Like, you are allowed to believe the way that you want to believe, just like I'm allowed to believe the way that I want to believe. Some questions that I often find myself asking myself frequently that I kind of think that we all can take time to reflect on are, am I doing what I can to make sure everyone's voice is heard by helping with elections, access to voting, and contacting representatives? Am I protesting laws, actions, and businesses that harm marginalized people? Am I coming to the aid of my siblings in Christ who are different races, genders, sexualities, religions, nationalities, and abled in times of crisis the same way I come to the aid of people who are just like me in times of crisis? If the answer to any of these questions was no, I, and we, by extension, need to do better. One example that I think of was right after I came home from my mission, I was working with a girl who was Muslim, and she had to wear a hijab with our wardrobe. Someone on my team complained about her hijab because one day it was black and the next day it was white. And they were like, well, the white distracts from the uniform and blah, blah, blah. They were being awful. I was just a regular team member at this point. I wasn't in leadership or anything. I talked to that team member and I was like, that's really offensive. I'm like, she is trying her best to observe her religious beliefs while wearing the uniform that she has to wear every single day. As well as the fact that, like, if you tried to tell me that I'm not allowed to wear my religious clothing, which I wear every day underneath my uniform, I would very strongly fight against you and fight you to the death because that's religious discrimination. You need to stop trying to police someone for believing and observing their religion the way that they do it because it's different from what you're used to. If you have questions about why she is doing this, ask her questions. Don't make assumptions and don't complain to her and to managers because she has to modify her uniform so that it works for her religious beliefs. And after that conversation, that team member never talked to me again because they were so mad that I would stand up for that team member. I ended up talking to my managers later that week because it was just bothering me so much. And I was like, if you try to come for this girl who is doing her best to live her religion, make money, and do what she needs to do to help take care of her family, I will personally fight you to the death about this because not only is it against the law, it's against company policy, it's an HR problem, and it's a lawsuit waiting to happen, which I will side with her, find shark-ass lawyers in Central Florida, and we will take the company for all it's worth. So don't even try to come for me at this point.
Seriously, good. And like, that's exactly what we need to be doing. We need to be supporting those around us. And whether, like, no matter how little or how much we know about different faiths, we need to be there to help and support one another. We need to encourage interreligious collaboration and communication, because the more people understand other faiths, the less likely they are to be so judgmental. Like, I've seen that in my own life for myself and for those around me, and people like learning, like, okay, here's what you do in certain situations. There's just like so much to learn. Like, I went to Dubai for a women's conference, and we had a ton of lessons about the culture and about the religious faith there. And it was very enlightening for me to better understand why people do the things that they do. And it started to make sense. And I could see the own correlations in my life. And I was like, they're holding to their faith and their God the same way that I do. And that is so insanely cool. I want to be able to respect them, and I want to be able to help them to do the, all that they can to have happy and fulfilling lives, because that's what I want for myself as well. You can see that when people understand one another better, they will treat one another better. The less that they do understand, the more harsh and judgmental and cruel that they will be. Honestly, if we all had, like, we're so much better educated in different faiths and everything, I totally believe, like, we would not have half the violence or pain that we have today.
So then we want to talk about how to ensure that we are not causing religious violence, because it's not enough to just say, like, let's protect ourselves. No, we need to protect other people too and make sure that it's not happening again, especially from us.
Right. This is for us, like, within our personal lives, within our faiths, and within our communities. There are small and big things that we can be doing.
Yeah. So the first thing we need to remember always is something that is deeply embedded into the doctrine of Christ, and that is to love one another. Christ taught to love everyone. I'm going to say that again. Christ taught to love everyone. You may not like them, you may not agree with them, but we are commanded to love our neighbor as ourselves, which is Matthew 22, verses 37 through 39. We teach this doctrine to children through primary songs like Love One Another, I'll Walk With You, or I'm Trying to Be Like Jesus, and many, many more. Christ taught us to love first and the rest would follow. In a May 1977 Ensign article, it says, quote, even more important than respecting other churches for the good work they do, we should respect our fellow human beings, not in spite of their beliefs, but because of them. A man or woman who carefully obeys all the laws and teachings of the Catholic or Buddhist or Shinto or Lutheran religion is obviously striving to do right. We should not condemn their beliefs, but rejoice in their righteous desires. How can we show them respect? We can treat things that are sacred to them with respect. We can observe the customs of other people when we are their guests. We must never ridicule another person's manner of worship. We can avoid arguing and quarreling over religious ideas. We can be kind to representatives of other religions. Above all, in our dealings with non-members of the church, we can remember that they are no less children of our Father in heaven than we are. We Latter-day Saints, who have felt the pains of intolerance and persecution, have a great responsibility and opportunity to show to others our love and tolerance and respect to those who believe in other faiths. End quote.
I love that. That is so important. And I do like the mention of the children as well, because children learn most things. They learn what love is. They learn how to communicate that. And they also learn what prejudice is. So we need to make sure that as we're around children, that we are giving them proper examples so that the next generation is doing good or doing better than we have been able to do.
Hatred is taught.
It very much is. And like, I've talked with people who, like, you know, they've never attended other churches. They don't know anything about other faiths. And they're like, yeah, I love this person. I just don't know them. And honestly, if you want to love someone properly, then I do feel that you need to get to know them. You need to be able to understand them. And I think that's where more of that love really comes from. You can love people without knowing them. Like, I accept that. But I feel like I learn how to love best when I understand what I am loving. We need to be learning all that we can to support one another and to love one another, and not just to try and convert them to the faith.
Love them, respect their beliefs, yes. And just love them. Mm-hmm. Do not have an ulterior motive. Just love them.
Yes. Like, I got to spend a little bit of time in China. I absolutely loved visiting open spaces that I was allowed in as a guest, like to attend other temples, to visit other places of worship in whatever way or shape or form they were. And it's a beautiful thing to learn about other people's belief systems and the things that they do to love their people and their community. It's amazing what you can learn. We should not ever be closing our eyes to that. Like, we need to be able to embrace all that we can. And there's no reason to spend time fighting and arguing over anything like that.
That leads us perfectly into the second thing that we need to do, which is we need to educate ourselves, not just on our faith, but on science, history, and many more topics. We need to educate ourselves to understand the world and the way people think and why. If you don't know much about other world religions, cultures, or people, start reading. Start educating yourself about them. Start making friends with people beyond your circle, and start respectfully incorporating different cultures into your life. A big reason religious violence occurs is because one group doesn't understand another. We've talked about that a lot from the examples that we've shared today about religious violence in history. There is so much conflict that could have been avoided if people would take a moment to recognize that the fear that they have of another body of people or religion is because they don't understand them. When we remove the fear with education and understanding, we can better see people for who they are, and they can see us for who we are, not for what we believe or for what our religion stands for, just for them, the person.
I love that. So the third thing after loving everyone and educating ourselves is to be checking on our own biases. I mean, we've talked about this a lot before in the podcast, but it's becoming more and more important for us to be able to check our conscious and unconscious biases. Harvard has an incredible project called Project Implicit. That's ongoing. It's online and free. It will allow you to check your implicit bias towards race, gender expression, sexuality, and more through like a series of very simple tasks and quizzes. We've both done a few of these tests, and the results are always eye-opening and a great jumping off point to better educate yourself. I don't know if you can ever be perfect, but you can definitely get better and you can improve. So we encourage you to check that out and to learn for yourself where your biases are and where you can be improving.
Definitely. And then the last thing we wanted to touch on is action that we need to take when we fear that our church is going in the direction of promoting religious violence. So the first thing that we wanted to suggest was that we need to speak up. We need to talk about it. Talk about it with the people that are around you. Talk to your local leadership. Write to general authorities. Don't just sit there and think that the church will never listen or change or anything, because we are living in a continual restoration. The prophets and apostles have all said that we are living in a continual restoration or an ongoing restoration. That means that the church is ever evolving and growing. It can change for the worst just as much as it can change for the better. All things in the church, like we discussed a couple weeks ago, have to be done by common consent. And if you are not giving your consent to things, you can make it known. So speak up, make your voice be heard in the church specifically. It could be the huge difference that is needed to be made in terms of any sort of policy or person being brought into a calling happening around you. So we wanted to give that note because we've seen concerns rising in the church specifically concerning policies that people agree and disagree with in the church. There is a change that Kaylee and I are desperately waiting for, and I'm sure many other members are desperately waiting for as well. But there's no telling what our leaders are going to decide next. We can choose what we do about it, no matter what they decide. We can choose to study the doctrine for ourselves and consider our personal revelation when anything is announced. When we spoke with Papa Osler last year, Richard Osler. I was going by his Twitter handle for a second. Richard Osler last year during our Pride series. In his book, Listen, Learn, and Love, he mentioned disagreeing with the November 2015 policy of basically refusing baptisms for children of gay parents, and then feeling at peace with that decision of, you know, not agreeing with the policy. He explains later that, like, in 2019, the policy was later changed and he felt even more peace about it. So what we're trying to say with this is, just because a policy is enacted in the church, it does not mean that you have to blindly follow it. We've talked about this so many times in this podcast, but, like, we have agency for a reason. We are allowed to choose what we follow, what we believe, what we disagree with. As long as you are doing your part to study for yourself, seek and gain personal revelation about these policies or commandments as they're being revealed, you are doing what the Lord wants you to do. And the Lord will tell you what you should agree with and what you should not agree with in those moments. And that's totally fine. Like, no one's going to penalize you for it if you decide you don't agree with a certain policy. Like, it's not like you're going to be burned at the stake for it. It's fine.
You might have some arguments with church leaders and bishops, but that doesn't mean they're not correct. They're just following what they think is correct. So it's through that communication and that collaboration that we spoke of that we can better learn and understand one another, even within our own faith, because we all understand things and believe things differently, no matter if we're in the same organization or not. Like, it's always a little bit different. Yeah, you might face some issues. Like, we've definitely faced issues in our own wards and everything. There's no way it's always going to be like a perfect scenario where everyone's like super happy and super feeling the same in the same ward. Like, that'd actually be kind of weird. But we do want to just offer a reminder that you're in charge of your own beliefs and you don't have to accept everything that is tossed your way.
And we've talked a lot about, like, building community this season and finding those people. And the best way to find those people that feel similarly to you is to speak up about it. Kaylee and I would not have found each other if we weren't willing to talk about our qualms with the church, our problems that we're experiencing, our own faith crises. Opening up and being vulnerable is what led us to one another, really, and what brought us to this podcast. So take those risks, speak up, talk about it, because the more you hold it in, the worse you're going to feel, the quicker you're going to move away from anything that you hold dear and precious in this life, and it's just going to be a mess. Just don't do it. Just talk about it.
Yeah.
So to wrap up today's episode, because it was a lot and it's going to be a lengthy episode, sorry guys, there were a lot of emotions that we ran through when we were preparing this episode, which is why we procrastinated so long in recording this week. and we don't assume that it was easy to listen to all of this. We had to confront a lot of our own experiences with the church history, with religious history, everything. And so we know that you all had to do that as well. And if you made it through the end of the episode,
and you made it through this journey, thank you so much for joining us. We hope that you are seeing a new side of the world that you didn't get to see before. And we hope that you are able to go forward from today's podcast and look at things around you, the people around you, the world around you with an open heart, a hopeful heart, a critical thinking, and just a broader view of things. Religious violence has truly decimated communities and countries in the past, and it continues to do that today. We really want this to stop eventually. I mean, it's going to take a long time for it to stop. We know because people are hard-hearted, hard-headed, but hopefully as we become more aware of what we can do one person at a time, we can make the changes necessary to bring the safety and security that we seek in owning our beliefs, whatever they might be.
Amen to that. We know it won't end suddenly, but what we can be doing is educating ourselves to start seeking that peace and encourage others to do the same. And hopefully with time, we can create that change. We need to be the change we want to see in the world. So let's start where we are today, confront our biases, and start connecting with others. That's really where charity is. That's the true, the pure love of Christ. So we encourage you to take that with you today and through the days that follow. Hopefully through that, we can find that peace. We can find that safety and we can find that love.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us. And next week, we are going to come at you with our book club episode.
So excited.
It's so exciting. We have a really big surprise in store for you with that episode. So,
so great,
get ready. It's going to be the best. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. Okay. So anyways, thank you again for joining us this week. We will see you all next week at Book Club.
Yep. Bye. Bye.